This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG for Friday, March 20th, the first day of spring. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, one business in town is closing, at least temporarily, while another new small business continues to grow. We'll check in with both. The Department of Fish and Game will manage for a different set of escapement goals for the Bristol Bay sockeye fishery this year, and one of the department's managers tells us what that means for him. There was a plane hijacking this week, a fictional one, to test the response of emergency responders. We'll find out how that went. And burbot are being caught on Lake Aleknagik.
They are as good as everyone says they are. They definitely taste a lot like cod.
One fisherman tells us as much as he's willing to disclose about how and where to find them this spring. Those stories and more coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. It was officially announced this week that Omni Enterprises will close the N&N Market grocery store in Dillingham today. N&N will come under the ownership of Chogyung Limited and the Sea Lion Corporation of Hooper Bay.
We'll be taking over on Saturday, March the 20th. N&N Properties LLC will be the operator and the owner of the store.
That's Dave Cottrell, the president and CEO of a Sea Lion investment subsidiary and now managing member of N&N. Shoppers like Dillingham's Deanna Beyer flocked to a 50% off sale starting Wednesday.
It is crazy. Try to find this parking spot here within, you know, two city blocks.
Or a cart.
Yeah, I was amazed I was able to find a cart.
The new owners say they will try to open for business next week after restocking the store's inventory. At a press conference Tuesday, Governor Bill Walker announced his plans to accept federal funding and expand Medicaid coverage for an additional 40,000 Alaskans.
Anytime you can provide health care for opportunity for over 40,000 Alaskans, that's a good thing. That's a good day to do that. That's the right thing to do, and that's why we're doing it.
If his legislation is adopted, the state will accept $146 million in federal funding to cover the expansion. By the year 2020, Alaska will have to cover 10% of that cost. Republican leaders say they are more interested in Medicaid reform than expansion. Last year's Iditarod champion Dallas Seavey crossed the finish line just after 4 a.m. Tuesday to take this year's title as well.
So far, I've just been doing what I love, man. Mushing dogs, making it fun, keeping it fun. And it seems like as long as you take care of the dog team, you know, make good decisions, good things will happen. The wins are a result of doing what we love.
Seavey finished about 4 hours in front of his dad, Mitch Seavey, who took second place. Aaron Burmeister took third, Jesse Royer fourth, and Allie Zirkel fifth this year. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska customers were put on notice of a major data breach. Alaskan customers make up 650,000 of the 11 million people whose personal information may have been stolen in a major cyber attack.
This is data going back to 2002, so this affects current and former members, in addition to other individuals and organizations with whom we may have done business.
That's a spokesperson with the company. Primera says they will attempt to contact everyone who may have been affected. And of the seven basketball teams from Bristol Bay who headed to state this week, only one advanced to the title game. In a rematch of last year's championship, the Dillingham Wolverines took on the Glen Allen Panthers, who pulled ahead by three in the final minute of the game. Dillingham had possession with 5 seconds left and a chance to tie. Here's Bob Thomas with the call.
The bounce goes to Schlegel at midcourt to the corner. Wide open three. No good. They drew up the perfect play. They had a wide open Cameron Bartman in the corner. The inbound pass came to Schlegel at midcourt. Schlegel with a couple of dribbles to Bartman in the corner. Had a good look, but it comes up short.
38-35 was the final in the boys' 2A title match in favor of the Glen Allen Panthers. Find more on this week's news at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Thanks for staying with us. Dillingham's N&N Market will close later today as ownership changes hands between Omni Enterprises and two village corporations, Chogyung of Dillingham and Sea Lion of Hooper Bay. We sent Hannah Colton to the store this morning, and she joins us by phone from there now. Hannah, good morning. What's the scene out there today?
Well, it's a lot more relaxed than it had been yesterday and the day before. There's still quite a few people here, about a dozen cars out in the lot and the lot next door. But there are plenty of carts at the moment.
How's the inventory look after this big 50% off sale?
surprisingly robust in the sections besides grocery, I should say. All of the produce and most of the perishables are gone. The meat especially went super fast. But the household goods and the clothes and the toys, there's still quite a bit left.
What do folks around there have to say today?
They seem relieved to see smaller crowds here. They said earlier this week it was overwhelming. One man said he's just coming in to see what's left over, buying backups of things that aren't perishable. One woman was grabbing, you know, a bunch of household cleaners as well as some specialty stuff, stir-fry sauce that she said she doesn't usually buy because it's too expensive. And one lady said, you know, she felt a little sad for the employees, like it was kind of the end of an era.
Well, it does sound like there was a lot of business there this week, and you've been there for several days. What did you see?
Yeah, I was in here on Wednesday shortly after they announced the sale, and within an hour, it was nuts in here. The lines at all of the registers were 6 or 8 or 10 people deep, and people were loading carts, multiple carts. People were holding their spots in line while people ran back and grabbed more items for the carts, so it was pretty crazy.
Well, if a person was to want to make a last-minute dash today on the closing day of NNN under Omni leadership, what would they go in for? What's left?
There's lots of canned soup and chili and beans. There's condiments, mayo, mustard, PB&J, plenty of house cleaning supplies. And for the bigger ticket items, I saw 4 microwaves and a mini fridge and some space heaters.
All right, so still a few things to scoop up there at NNN. Hannah Colton reports for KDLG and for the Bristol Bay Times on the scene of the NNN market today. Hannah, thanks so much.
Thanks, Dave.
Another small business here in Dillingham is just taking off. Consider for the moment the value of the photos, text messages, contacts, and other things you store on your digital device. You probably don't stop to think about that much until that digital device stops working or takes a drink. Much of our lives, even in rural Alaska, is lived on 3-inch screens, and it can be frustrating and expensive when they break. KDLG's Matt Martin spoke with one man in the business of fixing them.
Standing behind the desk of his tiny shop next to the laundromat in downtown Dillingham, Stephen Longfin repairs the broken screen of a Galaxy S5.
And they have a really nasty habit of getting their screens broken when people drop them.
He uses a blow dryer to heat the glue that holds on the screen. He then slides a guitar pick under the screen to break it away from the rest of the phone.
Guitar pick actually works really well because it's thin enough and plasticky enough that it won't break any kind of metal components underneath. And you can actually just slide it in.
And then you just peel the screen right off. In the cell phone repair world, everything is small. His desk is covered in tiny screwdrivers and screws that would look small to even an ant. Originally a fisheries biologist, Stephen Longfin came to Dillingham to get back into the field.
And one of the things I did in my spare time was work on electronics.
On a whim, he advertised on the Dillingham Trading Post on Facebook that he could fix people's phones if anyone was interested.
It just exploded in popularity. I mean, there were hundreds of replies to it.
He was overwhelmed by the response. He had to
start taking notes and names and spreadsheets and, you know, order forms. And it was just like this, all of a sudden, this thing that snowballed into something that was, you know, took over my day and all of my time.
Longfin has always viewed himself as somewhat of an entrepreneur.
It was immediate, that a service like this was needed in town.
He saw an open market and jumped on it. He opened his shop shortly thereafter.
The business has just taken off since then.
Outsiders may not think that a town of 2,500 people would need a business for technology repair. Typically, expert cell phone repair doesn't come to mind when you think of rural Alaska life.
It definitely does show you where technology fits into our life. And the fact that people have, you know, family photos on their phones and keep in contact with their family members and they use it for their business, it really shows our reliance, you know, and the fact that even Bush, Alaska is, you know, in the 21st century when it comes to technology.
Back at his desk, Longfin attaches a new screen to that Samsung Galaxy.
And that's that. And then you have a new screen, put some glue on it, throw it on, and you're all done.
In Dillingham, I'm Matt Martin.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG, and we'll be back in a moment. Thank you. The Dillingham City Council met last night, and joining us for a quick recap, as she often does, is Mayor Alice Ruby. Mayor Ruby, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Let me start first with a question about a change in town here, which is our Inn & Market closing today and hopefully reopening next week. Do you have any thoughts about this?
Well, yeah, really interested in what's happening and hopeful that things are going to work out and the store will continue. There's, you know, and the city's concern is there's a lot of jobs there and a lot of commerce and certainly, you know, services and sales tax, property tax, everything that goes along with having a large store like that in the community. So we're really just sort of observing from the sidelines and hoping that everything, you know, works out well in the end for the store.
I think we'll know a little bit more by next week. Last night's city council meeting, not a whole lot of city business to attend to, but one thing that was addressed are some of the preliminary steps about how the city will regulate marijuana. And there was some ordinances introduced about some small fines. What step are we at with those?
Well, the ordinances that the council introduced last night really have to do with just modifying the current city codes to include marijuana in those. And those are the codes people probably recognize as the smoking in public and smoking in public places. And then, you know, the use of marijuana by children under the age of 21. And the codes introduced last night would just establish the fines for those kinds of things. And they're part of what the city can do now while we wait for the legislature to sort of put the regulations in place that will allow the city then to regulate commercial sales down the road.
And that's part two there of what the city will need to address at some point. So waiting on the legislature, but I also got the sense from the council that they are waiting on some input from the public.
They are. Now, the normal process for codes is that we introduce them, then we hold public hearings, then we adopt. In the case of the marijuana laws, too, the council felt that they wanted to make sure we had maximum public input, and not only on the two codes that we adopted last night, but just in general as well, because as the year goes by here, there's going to be more and more regulations by the state under which the city will, you know, start crafting their codes in the future. Plus, there are a lot of issues, you know, on the horizon of funding and all kinds of things that have made the council think that, you know, doing additional public meetings is probably a good idea now, and we haven't done any for quite a while.
Alice Ruby is Dillingham's mayor. Alice, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Dave.
This week, the emergency responders in Dillingham conducted a required test of their availability to respond to a crisis, in this scenario, a hijacked aircraft. KDLG's Matt Martin was on hand to observe the exercise.
This is the disaster drill. We have a hijacked aircraft inbound for Dillingham in 10 minutes. I need fire, EMS, the police department, and state troopers respond to the airport.
With hazard lights flashing, a Pan Air passenger van stood in on the tarmac for the hijacked Saab aircraft. Alaska State Troopers and Dillingham Police negotiated by phone with the fictional hijacker before he set the plane ablaze. Firefighters and EMS rescued victims covered in fake blood and mock broken bones, quickly getting them to the hospital. Norman Iano is the Dillingham Airport manager. He helped organize and coordinate the drill. He says trainings like this one help to find where there are holes in the system.
When you do this, you can see your shortcomings. And, you know, and also practice what is good. You know, I mean, that makes the operation work.
From Thursday's run-through, INO saw room for some improvements, like better coordination between the different agencies involved. But overall, he was satisfied with the drill.
We had a good turnout. I mean, a lot of response, victims, responders, and, you know, even Electnica came down to help us.
INO says the main objective of these drills is to be ready to protect the people in the region, come what may. In Dillingham, I'm Matt Martin.
We're glad you've stayed with us this Friday. This week, the sockeye escapement goals for most of Bristol Bay's rivers changed. based on an 18-month study by an advisory panel made up of fish scientists, economists, and fishermen, as well as processors. The escapement range will widen by raising the top end and keeping the low end the same. The study says this will put year-to-year variability in escapement rather than in the catch. To talk more about this with us is the area management biologist for the Nooshigak and Togiak Commercial Fishing Districts, Tim Sands. Tim, we're glad to have you.
Glad to be here, Dave. I really appreciate the opportunity to reach out to a mass audience here and explain what this means to everybody and to the department, because I know a lot of people will be interested.
Well, it's about 100 and some odd page study, and then there are a fair amount of numbers here. Your first glance, what does this mean to you?
Well, it means business as usual to the department. And really, this is more towards the action at the board than the study itself. Basically, the escapement goals that are going to be in place for the 2015 season and beyond are kind of a mix of the lower end of the old escapement goals and the higher end that was what was proposed by the department in 2012.
Your midpoint goes up.
The midpoint goes up, and that's probably the most significant thing for fishermen is the midpoint goes up, and that directly impacts the 48-hour transfer period and the waiving of the 48-hour transfer period, because we typically waive the 48-hour transfer period to a district once we've reached the midpoint.
We'll use the Wood River as an example. The midpoint goes from 1.1 million up to 1.2 and a half million under the AP's recommendations. That's down a little bit from the 2012 fish and game recommendation of 1.3 million, but it's still up. What's that mean for you?
Like I said,
do you have a hard time getting there? Is it
no? You know, for the wood, we've typically ended in the upper half of the goal most years anyway. Sometimes over the goal, like last year. But no, because we're trying to get more fish up the Nooshigak River because it's lagging behind usually, we end up towards the higher end of the Wood River goal anyway.
Now, they want to put language in to encourage the manager, to force the manager, I don't know, to manage for the lower end on lower run years and the upper end on upper end years. Is that a change for you?
No, that's business as usual for the department. We've always tried to kind of manage proportional to the run. So in a big run, we put more fish in the river, in a smaller run, less fish in the river. In general, we've always tried to do that.
Now, the most noticeable change, I think, is that the department's recommended goals before the Board of Fish in 2012 raised the lower end, I think, on every river. These keep them the same. Do you think biologically there's any effect from that keeping them the same?
No. The goals we had before were sustainable. You know, every few years we reanalyze all the data and look at them and see. And in most cases, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find more than a few cases that, like more than five cases in the last 30 years, that the new lower-end goals weren't already being met.
Okay.
'Cause so really, there's not a lot of difference there.
Now, both the department and the advisory panel here recommend raising the upper end with the idea of what?
Producing a few more fish in the long term.
Is that something that people will see in one life cycle or for the next four decades?
Well, in theory, within a life cycle, they'll start seeing that change, potentially, and it should last forever. You know, as long as we're within those ranges, the average is moving up a little bit because we think the systems can produce a little bit more fish on average than they're producing, and by putting a few more spawners in there.
These are minor tweaks to escapement, maybe not minor tweaks, but these are tweaks to escapement to manage for the long-term health of the fishery. Do we have a healthy fishery now? Do you think it will be that way in the future?
I absolutely think we have a healthy fishery now. You know, you don't have to look very far back. If you look from 2003 onwards, we had eight straight years where our run to this district was in the top 10. And that's of over 100 years of fishing. I mean, they started fishing here in 1883 was the first harvest. And we have records to 1893 and top 10 years. 2006 was the number one year. And then 2010 is number two. And 2007 is number three all time. to me, that indicates that things are healthy and sustainable.
Tim Sands, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
In other fish news this week, we were glad to see photos of burbot caught out of ice fishing holes on Lake Aleknagik. The odd-looking fish is known as one of the tastier of Alaska's freshwater fish, but they're hard to find. Some say they've caught them up the Nooshigak. Others say they're found readily in the Tikchik Lakes, but those who know of their existence in the Wood River Lakes have kept that secret well guarded. Through two winters, Christopher Strube, a lifelong resident of the area but new to Aleknagik, has been after these burbot and finally found them this week, which he stresses was with the help of those he can't name and at a spot he can't disclose. Still, we welcome whatever it is he is allowed to share. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Hey, no problem.
Tell me about catching these burbot.
Well, I started going on the search for them over a year ago, and I had a chance to put out some lines last year, but due to the kind of deteriorating lake conditions last year, I had to pull my lines and didn't get much of an effort in. But this year, I kind of went back to it, and I didn't bother earlier in the season. I waited till basically what my research said that was the best time of year, January, February, March, and into April, when they tend to come up in the shallow water to spawn. And it's a night fishery. You know, you gotta put the time in and go out after the sun goes down, or go out really early before the sun comes up. But they are out there in Aleknagik.
You say that folks up there do know that they're there and do catch them once in a while, but lately it's been pretty good.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. You know, the other night we got three of them landed, and there was another one that I lost pulling up from the bottom, but, you know, that's fishing.
Did you get a chance to eat them yet?
I did, and they are as good as everyone says they are. They are a freshwater cod, and they definitely taste a lot like cod. They got a nice, firm, flaky meat to them, and we deep-fried them, made fish and chips, and they were excellent.
Without giving away too many of your secrets, do you have recommendations on approximately what depth you might look to fish a hole or a lure you might try?
I haven't really figured out the best depth. I've read that you can find them as shallow as 2 feet of water under the ice this time of year, but I think they tend to stay deeper until it gets dark, and then they come up in the shallow. So, you know, I don't think anything over 40 feet is really worth trying. And then fishing about a foot off the bottom, just jigging, little piece of smelt or something on there to give a little flavor.
Chris, we've had a spell of warm weather. Is it still safe to travel up on the lake?
You know, anytime it warms up like this, any of the open creeks and stuff, the mouths are getting pretty thin, and those mouths could open up quite a ways out without much warning. I'd say if people are going to go, I mean, don't just head out at night unless you've been keeping up on the ice. And if you do want to go, try to get out there in the daytime when you got good daylight and figure out your trail before you're going to head out there. Just stay away from the thinner spots.
I guess it's exciting to know that they are there. I know some people had sort of been skeptical to know for sure, even though it seems like some folks there do know about it. So it was nice to see the pictures this week from your catch.
Yeah, it's kind of nice to know that I didn't waste a whole bunch of time. Last year when I started getting into it, I knew they were in the upper lakes and in the upper Nooshigak, and I didn't see why they wouldn't be in this lower lake. And so I just started talking to people, locals, and I heard stories about them catching them in their nets a long time ago, but I hadn't really heard any recent stories, but just kept at it and finally got some.
Well, like they say, a bad day of fishing is still better than dot, dot, dot. Chris Strube of Aleknagik, thanks for telling us about your burbot catch this week.
Hey, no problem.
Across the field where the creek turns back by the old stumble road, I'm gonna take you to a special place that nobody knows. Baby, get ready.
The Sikuliak is a new ice-capable research ship owned by the University of Alaska and the National Science Foundation. On its way to a test drive in sea ice up north, the Sikuliak made a port call in Dutch Harbor this week. Now, Unalaskans are used to vessels big and small tying up to their city dock, but as KUCB's Annie Ropeek tells us, they say they've never seen anything quite like this one before.
The spacious bridge of the Sikuliak looks like something out of science fiction. It's packed with navigational touchscreens and high-tech thrusters with a sleek black and blue color scheme. But for the dozens of Unalaska kids on board, the floor-to-ceiling view is the biggest draw.
She likes the windows. Did you see the water?
2-year-old Lennon Richardson has been toddling all around the ship with her mom, Alicia, and her brand new baby brother, Asher. This is his first research vessel, but Lennon is an old pro. Alicia says they've toured the fish and wildlife ship Tekla in Unalaska before. It's only about half the size of the Sikuliak.
I think that's the biggest difference. It seems like there's a lot more going on. Could get a lot more specialized than maybe what they did over there.
The Sikuliak was specially designed to support all kinds of research, from fisheries to climatology to microbiology, and to do it in up to a meter of sea ice. The ship's got wet labs, dry labs, computer labs, cranes, and space for more than 40 crew and scientists. Middle school teacher Amber Wood has brought some of her students on board today. She says some of them have toured boats like the Wildlife Trooper patrol vessel Stimson or the Coast Guard icebreaker Healy in Unalaska before. But this ship and tour are a lot more science-focused.
It's pretty cool, especially since so many of them are affiliated in some way to the fishing industry, like whether parents work, you know, in the different processing plants or work on a boat themselves or have small private vessels. So it's pretty cool for them to be able to see, like, the next level up, the bigger level up.
The Sikuliak is on its way to test out all those next-level instruments and capabilities on the ice. Chief Scientist Karen Ashton of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution says they don't have a lot of set plans for actual research, though you never know what might come up.
One way you could think of it is science of opportunity. So we have people.
Ashton's no stranger to Unalaska. She and many colleagues have sailed through before on ships like the icebreaker Healy, on the same kind of research missions the Sikuliak is designed for.
Yeah, she's got a really great suite of sophisticated sensors, a really big back deck, much bigger than the Healy's.
Ideally, she says the Healy would still do research in thicker winter ice up north, and the Sikuliak would cover thinner ice, which it's named for in Inupiaq. The vessel is home-ported in Seward, but the deepwater port of Dutch Harbor is a closer fuel stop to the Arctic, and it's ice-free all year. That means residents could see the Sikuliak a lot in the future. Ashton says she always likes stopping in Unalaska, whether she's introducing a ship or the research it's doing.
I really started talking to the community in the late 2000s, and they've been interested in climate change and what's going on with the weather and the environment ever since I started coming up here. You know, it's always fun to come to talk in Dutch because people ask great questions.
The Sikuliak will spend about the next 3 weeks in the northern Bering Sea near St. Matthew Island. Then they'll head home, bringing the results of their maiden sea ice voyage back through Unalaska on the way. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
There was a poetry slam last weekend in Dillingham, and we have just enough time here to share one of the poems with you today. Here's Dillingham Elementary student Jisa Ray with a poem she wrote and read last Friday.
School. I love school, even though math is worse than a bath. But homophones, why so funny, like a bear chased a bunny. And reading, oh boy, think about the magic in the joy, as I put my nose in a book, just look. I see pictures in my head while I read in bed. I write about the pool when I am in school. Yes, I love to learn.
Again, that was Jisa Ray at last week's Poetry Slam in Dillingham. It's been quite a week for sky watchers. A major solar storm made for some reportedly phenomenal aurora borealis this week, visible much further south than usual, and especially so along the Iditarod Trail. Today marks three cosmic events, the spring equinox, a supermoon, and a total solar eclipse. Unfortunately, none visible here. The eclipse was mainly limited to northern Europe. A supermoon is the name for the time when either a full or new moon happens when the moon's at its closest approach to Earth, known as its perigee. Today's supermoon is a new moon, so it's not visible either, but it's still pretty cool to know. Welcome to spring officially. That's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond, our weekly news magazine on KDLG. Please send your feedback and ideas to news@kdlg.org or to me at dave@kdlg.org. We hope to see you back here next week.
Everybody here is out of sight.